Hello and welcome to the Alparana podcast. I'm Aditya. We also have Deepak joining today. This episode is not in cinema, at least not entirely. This podcast has always been about taking the world of South Indian cinema to a wider audience, especially the older undiscovered films or those films that are rarely talked about by people who don't speak the southern languages. Our special guests today have done something far greater than in a similar vein. They've translated the works of one of the finest writers in modern Tamil literature, B. Jayamohan, to take it to a wider audience. Jayamohan, of course, happens to be a screenplay writer as well, so not exactly outside the purview of this podcast. This will be our second episode that has to do with literature books. Earlier, we had done an episode on Tamil Prabha's Petai with Arivu and Kavitha Muralidharan. So on to our guests, we have Sujitra Ramachandran, who writes fiction in Tamil and English, and a translation of Jayamohan's Ayamulagam was recently published called The Abyss. Hi Sujitra.
Hi Aditya, thank you.
We also have writer Premada Ramkumar. Her translation of Jayamohan's short story collection called Stories of the True was published last year. Hi Premada, thanks for joining us.
Hi Aditya, thank you for having me.
So diving right in, I'll start with Premada. Can you briefly talk about your journey in getting into Tamil literature and then moving to writing and translating? Just briefly.
Sure. I must say it's quite an unflattering journey, but I'm happy to talk about it. Just dialing back a bit to my childhood, I actually grew up learning Tamil formally in school. Unfortunately, though, in our academic syllabus, we hardly come across contemporary literature. So although I had a great love for Tamil from the little that I was exposed to in school, I did not read any contemporary literature. And then when I went to college, the first couple of years of my commerce education at Selamaris in Chennai, we did have to learn language as well, and there we were exposed a little bit to contemporary Tamil literature, but more popular fiction, I'd say. So I read the likes of Vasanthi and so on. It was a long while later, actually in 2012, I think, when my now husband actually introduced me to the book that I eventually translated, which was Aram, that I really got initiated into contemporary Tamil literature. So my translation journey as well as my journey into Tamil literature has kind of been synchronous. When I read Aram, I really felt like I had read nothing like this before in English. And, the emotional depth of the book just sort of blew me away. And of course, at that time, I really didn't know that I would end up translating this book, but it stayed with me for a long time. How I got initiated into Tamil literature. And then from there, of course, I've tried to read widely, tried to read the masters, Ashokamitran, Sura, Jayakanthan, and also contemporary writers like Sunil, and of course, Suchitra herself is a writer in Tamil, and so on. But that, in short, has been, I think, my journey till date. So I see myself very much as a student of Tamil literature still.
Sujitra, I've known you like since the blog world, so I kind of followed that journey, but yeah, if you could just go on.
Oh, absolutely. Like I think where I differ from Priyamada is I did not learn a lot of Tamil in school formally, just because some of my education was not in Tamil Nadu. So, but I learned to read Tamil when I was 15 from my grandmother, so it was kind of I taught myself to read, but most of my reading was in English. I think my sort of introduction to Tamil literature was actually through music, so through Tamil Isai, just because I have an interest in classical music. And I think it sort of grew from there, and then I started reading a little bit of poetry, and I tried to do it with the help of translations. When I was reading a lot in English and just contemporary fiction, things like that. Then I also kind of wanted to learn more about sort of Tamil history, Indian history, or what kind of literature has been written in Indian languages. And you know, there were some books where it kind of led me back. It kind of made me want to explore more. For example, I read M.T. Vasudevan Nair's book called Randamuram. It's a translation of that when I was 18. And you know, it was unlike anything I had read in English. And I thought, okay, if this is Indian literature, maybe I should read more of this. Where do I find books like this? And Malayalam is not my mother tongue, Tamil is. So then I started to see if I could read more Tamil literature. I was sort of very confused. I was sort of going back and forth. But then I think I seriously got into it only when I was in Pittsburgh, when I was a graduate student. And I started to read a lot of contemporary Tamil literature, but in translation. And some of the translations were good, others were you know, sort of left more to be desired. But, you know, I never thought I would become a translator. My goal was to basically read more and discover more. And then I started reading in Tamil itself. And I realized like I was not that bad of a reader in Tamil. I could read pretty fast. And in within a couple of years, I was able to, I had actually read pretty widely, I thought. And then it was then, I think, around that time that I discovered Jayamohan as part of that journey. And then, yeah, I translated one story for the heck of it. And it was received well. So I thought, why not? And that was how I think I became a translator. But yeah, before that, I think I tried my hand at translating some Sangam poems, but that was mostly a lark. Like I didn't do it with the intention to be a translator. I think it was more just to just for understanding the poems for myself and sharing it with a wider audience. But I think now looking back, I think sort of all those steps, little steps, sort of have cemented the way that eventually led me here. So that's my journey in a nutshell.
So Chitra, was the Randamuram translation, was that Prem Panika's translation that he put up on his blog? Yeah.
Yes, yeah, it was. I know that was, I think, the first time I came across any contemporary a translation of a contemporary work by an Indian language author, like non-English Indian language author. So I think I was 17 or 18 at that point, and it was something else.
Yeah, so for our audience, I don't know if Prem's blog Smoke Signals is still up and whether the translation is still up, because he used to release them for free on his blog. If he does have it, I would encourage, it's still up there, I would encourage people.
I remember he created a PDF of the whole thing and even uploaded it, but I don't know if it's still there. Yeah.
Yeah. Sushitra has now prompted me to go back to my Gmail archives because I remember emailing it to myself. I have to go and see if I still have it.
It's not wrong to say that it's kind of a happy accident for both of you, but in terms of, I'm a very, very recent entrant into the Tamil literature, but in terms of the readership and the world itself, it is very rich, but it's also a kind of a small insider world, and it's also self-sustaining. It's not like you say, oh, this is dying, but it never dies because it has a very passionate audience and very and brilliant writers keep coming along. How has your encounter with it been? Is that something similar that you also noticed, and is that something that led to the translation?
I think now having seen a bit of both the worlds, the Tamil readership as well as the English language reading world. I would definitely say that, you know, there is a very vibrant ecosystem as far as Tamil is concerned. I feel that it is far more vibrant than what I see in English today. Maybe the fact that, you know, we are such a close-knit ecosystem helps, but there is a real exchange of ideas and opinions and views amongst readers, honesty of pursuit in the way we exchange their views as well, I feel, that I feel is a little missing in English. But more importantly, I think there is a vibrant relationship between readers and writers, which I think really goes a long way in keeping our interest as readers and even growing as readers. I think there's a very strong epistolary relationship, if I can call it that, even today. That's how I sort of entered Jayamohan's world. When I read Aram, I immediately wrote to him. His email was available on his website, and I wrote to him in mostly English because I was quite challenged with Tamil back then. And you know, one thing led to another, and soon you were in this community where you actually did not know before at all, both in person and virtually. And I feel that sort of exchange today is a little bit lacking in English, and you know, that is one of the reasons we also started Mori, which maybe we'll talk about later. But I do feel that it's a very vibrant ecosystem that we have in Tamil. Although I wouldn't call it small, because again, taking the example of Aram, I think we've sold almost, in Tamil, it has sold almost more than a lakh of copies. And that's, you know, by no means small if you take any language as a standard. So certainly geographically contained or constrained, but it's still a large and vibrant community is how I see it.
And if I may add to that, Priyamada, I think when you mentioned the epistolary sort of tradition that's there, where you can, you know, write to authors, meet them, the sort of the camaraderie that exists, and where writers welcome readers and readers go to writers. I think for me, it was also the fact that I could write to a writer and expect a response. Like, you know, it wouldn't be an email that lands in their inbox and I would never hear from them again. I mean, with most Tamil writers that I've interacted with, there's a genuine sort of passion. They want to talk to their readers. They want to kind of exchange ideas with readers. So in that sense, it's very, very vibrant. There's a sense of wanting to build conversations and wanting to groom young writers. So like, again, going back to my blog days, when I kind of knew early on that I wanted to do something in literature, right? But I wasn't sure, you know, what to write, how to write. I didn't have a community of sorts. And in English, I feel like the way the publishing industry is structured, and maybe I haven't knocked at all the right doors yet. But so far, the sense that I get is it's very hard to get into. To really learn from practicing poets or writers. And I don't think it was always the case, because, you know, when you read about poetry, a tradition of poetry in English, Indian English, you have, for example, the Bombay school, which was this tight-knit group of poets like Dim Morais and Nazim Esekiel and so on. So they, you know, sat and worked together, they lived together, and they produced something. So coteries like that, I'm not sure if they even exist in English today. But in Tamil, it's very vibrant. And when I first encountered this world, it was sort of like discovering an underground society of sorts. And the fact that, you know, these were people who were actively reading, were actively collaborating, new writers were coming up, they were writing exciting things. They were doing formally, stylistically new things, pushing the boundary with things that you could immediately relate to, you could learn. So, yeah, I agree with Priyamada and that it's very vibrant. And I think it's also a growing sort of community. And if I may add one more thing, I think this sort of a community exists in languages which have a history of an intellectual tradition, like Bengali or Kannada or Malayalam. In Tamil, it's there, it's small, but I think it's really growing. And I think I think we have sort of, we don't have to be ashamed that in Tamil, we don't have that kind of a community or anything like that. It's certainly there and it's certainly growing.
Yeah, I think Jaimon himself talks about this many times his blog. He says, இலக்கியம் என்றுமே ஒரு சிறிய தீவிரமான கூட்டத்தால் மட்டுமே பிழைக்கிறது or something that, like that, he keeps using this some variation of this terminology.
No, I was surprised that this actually has like a this harks back to the right to the period post independence. There's a book, a small book by a writer and critic called Kana Subramaniam. It's called இலக்கியத்துக்கு ஒரு இயக்கம், இலக்கியத்துக்கு ஒரு இயக்கம், a movement for literature. And it's one of, you know, he's sort of considered one of the forefathers of modern Tamil literature. And he makes sort of a call. He says, if a language is to remain vibrant and if it's to, you know, create new ideas and sort of renew itself, then it's absolutely necessary that there be a coterie of readers. He says a goshti, that's the word he uses. Like in each town, he calls for a group of, say, 200 or 300 serious readers who in some form communicate among themselves, who are able to kind of read and discuss new ideas and push the boundary. And you know, Karnasam was very much sort of an aesthetician in a sense. But I think it also equally applies to social political ideas. You really need these institutions or you know these loose coteries where people can get together and talk. So certainly that's the spirit, and I think it's sort of been sustained through the ages and all the way down to us.
Yeah, I think like for me, I think that there's two things happening in parallel over the course of the 80s, 90s, and the 2000s, right? Which is one is there's a Sirupatrike Ulagam, which is separate from the large Tamil publications. So there's probably three or four very large popular Tamil publications where occasionally good literature would filter and find its way up there. But for the large part in the 80s and 90s, there's a world of small small publications which are printing like 10,000 copies, 5,000 copies, 6,000 copies, and sort of hand delivered, and a very small group of people read the short stories or read the serialized fiction that would get published there. And that kind of it thrived primarily through those small publications. But then with the coming of the internet, I think like it democratized this loose coterie that Karnasu talks about, and made these loose coteries that were, there used to be one in Erode, there'd be one in Tiruparangundram, one in Thiruvannamalai, one in Madurai Ramanathapuram, and all of those people found their way to the internet. And in some senses, I think like the coming of the internet and the fact that Jaimon was so prolific on the internet made him, in some senses, it was between Jaimon and maybe Charu Nivedita, but like the made him sort of the one of the like the person who became the focal point of this of the literature movement on the internet, right? And so at least that's how I came to Jaimon. So I started out reading Kumudam Anandavidan, Kalkandu, all that stuff, and then at some point it only feeds so much of your soul to read those things. And so you read Kanayari and you read Sujata's responses in Kanayari on the back. And then eventually you're like, okay, this doesn't feed my soul enough. And so you need to read Jayakanth, and then you need to read Sura, then you need to read Karnasu or Teeja. And so you make this progression yourself, but then I found Jaimon primarily through the internet. I was wondering whether that's true for you, Suchitra, and you, Priyamvada, as well. How did you guys find Jaimon? And then finding Jaimon, there's two parts to finding Jaimon, right? Like finding Jaimon himself just as a reader, and then finding Jaimon's place in the overall like universe of Tamil literature. How did you guys come about those two things? Maybe we can start with Suchitra and then we can go to Premala.
Sure.
Yeah,
as you were saying all that, I realized something. Yeah, I mean, a person like me, born in my time and place, I don't think I would have managed to make my place in this world if it was not for the internet. I think it's incredibly rare for women to in the past at least, it was very rare for women to know that such a world existed, and even if it did, find the sort of courage to make their mark there. And certainly there have been women who have written. Ambai is there, Perundevi, there are women writers who have managed to make a mark, but it's far and few between. They are exceptions, but today I think that's really blown. I mean, people from all walks of life, people across boundaries of any kind. I think this the fact that these avenues are available through the internet, it really democratizes it, as you say. for me, discovering the question about discovering Jayamohan, I think I was basically working my way through a list of writers. At some point, I think I just, whenever I would hear the name of a new Tamil writer, I would note it down and I'd find one or two books by them. I was in the US and I would borrow books from the library or source it on the interlibrary loan and I would read it. But then I think it was through that I came across the name of Jayamohan. I might have read one or two articles on his blog, but I wanted to read a book. And then I think that's how I read Purappad. The book I know pretty well if a writer is sort of my kind of writer or not, and with Jayamohan. Just reading Purappad made it evident to me the sort of quest that he exhibited. It's very similar to other writers who have had a significant impact on me, people like Hermann Hesse or Thomas Mann or Tolstoy, for that matter. I mean, that's the league in which I thought this writer figured in. So I kept reading more, but then I realized that Jayamohan also had this blog where he was talking about what's good literature and how you can look critically at literature and things like that. And that was really educational for me. And to be honest, up until then, I've been reading a lot, but I think I was kind of just using my nose to navigate, trying to figure out what I wanted to do with all the literature I was reading. But I think Jayamohan's ideas gave me a framework to start thinking independently about what I was reading make my own judgment, so to say, develop my own taste. And as a critic, I think that's one of his greatest contributions to Tamil literature and even Tamil society, the fact that he's cultivating taste among so many readers. It was four or 5 years after I discovered him that I got to meet him. And then at that point, I had already translated a story that he had written. So that's how it happened. Certainly his influence on cultivating a generation of readers, I think it will be spoken about for a long time to come. That's my impression.
Yeah, I think it's interesting also, Deepak, the reference that you made to the Little Magazine movement, because one of the things I remember Jayamohan speaking about in one of the early interviews after Stories of the True was launched was how he envisioned his own website as a little magazine. And he talks about how it wasn't just to foreground his works, but foreground the works of emerging writers and serve as a platform for almost critical discourse on Tamil literature. And that's really the way I think it has played out, and the reason so many people follow his blog today. For me, the journey to Jayamohan, as I touched upon a little while earlier, was really started with Arab. Once I read the book, I devoured many of the essays and short stories on his blog, and that had me really hooked. I think probably the second book that I picked up was in fact Purappad, as Suchitra said. Another book of his that is very unique. It's a travelogue, but it's more than that, because I feel it's also a little fictionalized, as is most of Jayamohan's works. And you really get a unique perspective of India that certainly someone like me, coming from my background, wouldn't be able to, partake of. His fiction world was one, the other world that I sort of entered into was the essays and not only on literary criticism, like Suchitra mentioned, but also sort of the personal essays, if I can call it that, that really helped me clarify for myself what is my purpose in life. It might sound a little big to talk about it that way, but I really do feel that, coming from a background where I was working in the corporate world, to acknowledge to myself that literature is a central part of my life and something that I want to think about seriously and not as a pastime, I think that clarity really came from reading Jayamohan's essays and eventually interacting with him and other readers. I think Suchitra and I actually ended up meeting Jayamohan in the same Meet the Reader, Meet that he holds. It was back in 2017, and by that
this
time
is the Vishnupuram. This is the Vishnupuram.
It's not the Vishnupuram literary meet that happens annually, but he was hosting these small meets in different parts of Tamil Nadu. I think we met in Tanjavur at that point of time, and again I had also translated a couple of stories from the Aram collection by then. And soon after meeting him, I gathered the courage to ask him for his permission to translate the entire work. And I don't know what gave him the confidence, but he said yes immediately. So then there was no looking back after that.
Yeah, I think like Jaimon and I have a interesting overlap, right? Like we're both Malayalis who spent a predominant amount of time in Tamil Nadu, and so. I have that in common with him, which I immediately found as sort of a kindred thing. But the second thing that I found very interesting is because of the time and place that Jaimon was born, he has this, his personal essays are personal, but they are also a, very much a window into the world of Tamil literature, right? Like, Ashokamitran and Sura and all of those great writers that Suchitra was referencing, they've all touched his life in some way, and they all find a way into his personal essays, right? Like he paints this picture of a very vibrant Tamil literature world often in his personal essays that makes it look very attractive for someone who is viewing it from the outside. The world itself, he paints a really great picture of the world itself and makes it very attractive. And it like actually does draw the, you know, if there's sort of this filtering process of like, hey, stay casual reader, but versus moving into sort of like literature and like being someone who cares about it a lot. Jaimon, if you like Jaimon, it's a very good filter of like, okay, you probably want to consider moving or crossing the chasm into being a really serious reader and maybe even potentially writer yourself. And you also get the sense that he has a very strong point of view of where he fits in that world. As readers or as translators, where do you guys evaluate where he sits in that world? Given how you came to his works, is it easy for you to sort of position him in the canon? Maybe we'll start with you, Priyamvada, this time.
Sure. I think at the end of the day, reading is a subjective experience, and therefore any sort of attempt at list making is going to be that, right? So my list might be very different from yours, but for me, given whatever I've read of Tamil literature so far, Jaimon is really up there amongst the masters, if not better. We've already spoken about Ashokamitran, Jayakanthan. I think of Pudmai Pithan as a pioneer, and I would rank Jaimon up there both in terms of literary merit as well as being a pioneering writer. Because in some ways, I think the novel form in Tamil, as he himself has said many times before, was probably born through Vishnupuram. More than that, I when I look at it as a translator, one of the reasons I was moved to translate Jaimon is I felt that he's up there amongst the great writers in the world. It's not, I mean, we'd be very almost mean-minded to contain him within Tamil, right? He's a writer that we must share with the world. And that's what really moved me to translate him. When I read him, I felt he's a writer who moved me as much as Tolstoy did. And to this day, I believe that, his ability to sort of magnify the inner world of human beings and talk about the human condition in the kind of depth that he does is very, very reminiscent of Tolstoy. More than, as just a master of the Tamil literary world, I think of him as a master in world literature.
That's great. Suchitra?
Uh, to add to that, you know, I think the point you make about how you discover an author and then would you really, you know, how they, and you know, after you have sort of been taken in sort of by their works, is there an objective way of really look? I think that objectivity in literature is a bit overrated. I think the first sort of in with any artwork, cinema or literature or any of the arts, I think the subjective sort of emotion or feeling that, you know, when a work moves us, we just know it automatically. So I think that's the first instinct that we go by. Yeah, and so I think that's where the subjectivity comes from. But then there are objective ways that you can, of course, talk to other people, and that's what criticism is, right? If I have to think of why I would say Jaimon is great objectively, I think I just want to focus on two things. One is, this is just based off of my reading of Tamil literature over the past 10, 15 years. One is his use of the Tamil language itself, you know, and he has pushed the boundaries of using the language in unimaginable ways. I think before him, the sort of the master of various Tamil style, just the different subjects and style in which, you know, you can twist and turn a language, that I think was Pudumai Pittan. And before that, it was probably Subramanya Bharathi who introduced modern prose, so to speak, into Tamil literature. So what Jaimon is doing with Tamil prose is on par with that, I think. You know, he's able to write in dialect, he's able to write in sort of the language of the subaltern, he's able to write an entirely classical language, he's able to compose poetry in you know, throw any period at him, he's able to do it. So just the raw use of language, what he's doing with it. So that's, I think, quite path-breaking. And like Priyamada said, formally, the great novel was something which he introduced almost to Tamil literature with Vishnupuram. That's an assessment that most critics make, and I think I would agree there. And I think his other very significant contribution is Tamil as a language is not a modern creation. It's really like, it's probably one of our, as Tamil-speaking people, I think we can certainly take pride in the fact that we have this unbroken tradition, right? It is a classical language, and it's just not the fact that it's you know, my language is older than yours. It's not that sort of a, you know, chest-thumping jingoism that I'm talking about. It's the fact that people have thought and recorded their thoughts in this language. The language itself is so deep. There are words for things and concepts that has come with the culture, and it still endures. It still endures in our day-to-day life. So in Tamil, when modern Tamil literature was, when it came into being, I think it was directly influenced by trends in Europe, by existentialism, you know, by ideas which were, I wouldn't want to say borrowed from the West, because I think existentialism is something you can always feel where, no matter where you're in the world, or modernism. So it's not that it was borrowed, but then, you know, there was, I think among Tamil writers, there was a significant lack of understanding or this feeling that, you know, you are writing in a language that has such a hoary heritage. I think what Jaimohan and a couple of other writers of his generation, what they've done is they've managed to stitch the old with the new. They've managed to, you know, bring those classical elements, the language, the ideas, the archetypes, and they've brought it into the modern medium. And I think that is very significant for two reasons. One is what it does to the language and literature itself, what it does to the reader, you know, what it gives the reader in terms of literary richness. The second is a more deeper cultural sort of a thing, where I think it binds the reader more closely with the world around him or her. If you've grown up in Tamil Nadu, you have a, you know, you grew up around a temple, you grew up around you know, Sirudeva, Varipadit sort of traditions. Though, you know, those can, some of those, you can stretch them, their origins back to the Sankamer or even earlier. So it gives you a sense of continuity with your own surroundings, and it kind of deepens who you are, the sense of who you are. Again, not in a jingoistic sense, not in a sense of saying, Nam Tamil and or something like that, but truly, honestly, if you really have that sort of a quest to understand who you are, where you come from, I think his writing has some ingredients that can start your quest. It can point you in the right direction. And it can, you can always talk to him, quote unquote, through his work and sort of start understanding for yourself where you come from, what your roots are. So, you know, his contributions to our understanding of history and culture through the fiction, that's really significant in my opinion. So I think for these two reasons, he will be counted as one of the sort of path-breaking masters of Tamil literature. And if I may add one more point, you know, why he's relevant not just to Tamil but to the world, I think that's because a lot of his themes have to do with the quest of an individual in a changing world, a world that, you know, where he's assailed by change at all times. A man anywhere in the world, there's change that comes, you know, from within you, from your relationships, from your own changing ideas, things like that. And then there's change that is coming from outside you, political unrest, social upheavals, things like that. And then there are things outside your control. The fact that you are born and the fact that you have to die, these are things that you have to confront almost at an existential level. So this is sort of the sort of the central quest that is pertinently there in Jai Mohan's work. And I think, you know, the kind of revelations or insights that you get from reading his work, like I said, the only parallel writers that I can think of are masters of the fiction form, like people with a quest, like Hermann Hesse or Thomas Mann or Kazantzakis or Tolstoy. So yeah, I think that's what I would like to say about Jai Mohan and how I can contextualize. Yeah.
I actually had it highlighted that I wanted you to expand on the translator's note that where you said he's a classicist in the tradition of Ilongo and Kampan, but I think you answered that question already, unless you want to add something more. Yeah.
No, I think I answered that.
Yeah, you answered that, yeah.
Yeah, so I just wanted to add one point here, right? Like I think you guys covered format, you guys covered like just like language usage itself, right? There's actually words that I wouldn't call myself a prolific reader of Tamil literature, but there are words that I had never read before I read Jai Mohan. Like, for example, the word padimam is a word like for image is a word that I had never seen used in common writing, in any writing, in fact, for that matter, in Tamil for such a long time. He does a great job of bringing it back. The one other point that I would add is just how prolific he is. He writes, it almost feels like he wakes up and sits down to write even before he brushes, and like often writes without eating. And like, you do get that picture sometimes, like he writes, he talks about how he writes in sort of a fever pitch a lot of times. The fact that he is able to reach a fever pitch so frequently is, I think, like is a huge gift. So that's I think it benefits us as readers.
Agreed. I've observed it firsthand. I think what disconcerted me was how casually he's able to do it. There was a time when I was in Europe and he had visited with his wife, and I got to spend a day or two. And at some point, you know, he would just disappear, and you'd just be talking, he'd disappear for half an hour, and he'll come back and he'd say that he has written whatever, half a chapter of Windmores, or completed a chapter or something like that. And just the fact that, like you said, he can remove himself from whatever's going on and reach a very high focus state of concentration, that's something, yeah, that's, I've seen similar levels of focus from, you know, other mentors when I was working in a more in a professional context, but not to this extent, and, you know, not with this sort of hyper focus. So yeah, that's something I've always admired, and you know, tried to see if I can emulate it to a little bit at least, certainly.
Yeah, it's also something that's very daunting about Devon. So when you take on his work as a translator, you have the sense that you need to keep your commitment and do it on time, although he doesn't really expect it or ask for a timeline. But it's good. I think it really gives us it's something like Suchitra said, it's definitely worthy of emulation. But he does it at a superhuman level, I think.
Can I ask a quick follow-up question as you talk about the daunting nature of it, right? Like you guys are talking about the daunting nature of it as a translator, which makes a lot of sense. I sometimes wonder, so I think in Purapada and in other places, he writes quite heavily about how he came to writing, right? Like how he had this psychological break when a really close friend passed away.
Yeah.
And he goes on this sort of travel through the subcontinent, of India. Primarily by walk and train and like very frugal means. I always wonder as a reader whether you have to have, like, personally for me, I've experienced sort of like something that really breaks within you, like a personal event that sort of really breaks you. And I think it like helps me understand Jayamohan or where he's coming from much better. I wonder if you have not had that experience, whether he is as accessible. Like, that's one question that I think about a lot of time. And maybe it's not a requirement. Maybe you just the fact of being a human is sufficient to understand where he's coming from. But I do wonder how accessible he is sometimes.
That's a good question. No, there was just one minor thing. I thought, I think, yeah, different people come to a reader, to a writer with, I don't think a certain writer is necessarily for all readers. I think different people come with different sort of questions. But I think, personally, for me, sort of hyper, I've not had like sort of experiences that Damon has had in his life. But I think I have sort of the questions that he grapples with in his fiction. I've attained it in various degrees through my life, and I think it's possible that people who have not had such intensity of experience could have attained to it. I think it's more about sort of your inner life when it comes to art or fiction than what necessarily happens in your outward life. Because, a lot of people go through war. They go through very sort of gory experiences too. But not all of them don't necessarily end up making art about it or developing a quest where they need to find a sort of a spiritual or an artistic solution to their aesthetic solution to their problems. So that's, I think it takes a certain kind of a mind and I think people who have that tend to relate to him better than people who don't. So I don't think it's so much about the intensity of what has happened to you as opposed to sort of the inner life that each person possesses and their own quest.
And before you go, I just want to just get into, since there was also a question about accessibility, I also wanted to get into the books itself, like Araman, Stories of the True. Like if you could add to the main challenges in translating, because it's also about real experiences, real people, some fictional versions of real experiences. So if you would just add to your answer about the challenges in that way.
Sure. On the previous question, I just wanted to add that it's also actually, as a reader, if you have a lack of such experience, the kind of experiences that you spoke about, it actually, I feel, attracts you to Jayamohan's writing even more. Because, there are two, again, going back to the question on, where he places on the literary canon, one of the things I feel is the reason why people of our generation especially are attracted to Jayamohan's writing is he came after a wave of modernism. So if you read Ashokamitran or Sura, their writing is almost placid, right? That was the aesthetics of their time. Probably in the mold of Hemingway, one could say. But with Jayamohan's writing, there is a magnification of that experience. you actually start to question whether he really had this experience or is it magnified for the purpose of fiction, right? And I think that especially like I said, coming after a wave of modernism, I feel the Tamil writer really, Tamil reader really sort of sat up and took notice of it. It also gives a very strong emotional core to his novels, in addition to what Suchitra spoke about as a sort of a largeness of vision, right? His ability to deal with the big questions, so to say. And I think those are also factors that make him the writer that he is. Coming to Story of the Two, on the translation challenges, I think, as a work, Aram, as you might know, is a strongly emotional work. And I felt that as a translator, that is something that I needed to retain. Because without that emotion, those stories will fall flat. While they are based on real people, they are really fictionalized in a very powerfully imaginative way. And I wanted to make sure that the experience that I had as a reader, in many of the stories, I remember being tears. That is something that I was very careful that I wanted to transmit to the reader in English as well. And I hope that I've been able to, achieve that. The second is in terms of the language itself. I think, being a short story collection, every story was different. It had a different rasa almost. And the language sort of needed to mirror that. And that took some work. I remember translating a story like Mail Kalutha, which I titled Peacock Blue in English. And, it had a lot of references to Carnatic music. And, how do you really... And with the references to those lines, you have almost an automatic response to what the author is trying to convey if you are familiar with Carnatic music, right? And how do you really convey that to into a language where the reader might not be as familiar with it? So I had to really work that much harder to achieve that. And it actually was one of my, one of the most famous, stories in the collection as a translator, I would say. And the third is, of course, the fact that in Stories of the Two, as with many of other, Jayamohan's works, there was a lot of dialect, and a dialect that kept changing from story to story. So that's an element that, unfortunately, one can't retain wholly in English. I did have my own devices to sort of circumvent that problem. But I think at the end of the day, the nature of the stories, the power of the writing, I think, withstood whatever little loss in translation there may have been with the challenge, especially with respect to dialect.
I want to ask a very particular question on Stories of the True. I think I've read the Tamil version. In fact, I read the Tamil stories as he published them on his blog. My favorite is Nooru Naatkaaligal or 100 Chairs. There is so much like localization in that story, in the sense of like what are you able to say about the mother? In fact, there are places where like I believe it's a story about a mother and a son and sort of how the son transcends his social situation to become an IAS officer. Can you talk a little bit about how you try to capture some of those things as you were translating to him? I know it's sort of very hard to talk about process maybe, but I did want to touch on that story in particular because it's a favorite of mine and I wanted to get your thoughts on it.
Sure. And that's one of the stories that have been noticed widely in English as well. So, and for very understandable reasons. But in terms of the translation, I understand what you're saying, Deepak, about the localization in that story. And I felt it actually, the story lent itself very well to translation because in in the story, if you you know, the mother is really seen almost as an alien character by the society, right? You know, she is not considered normal. Even her son has to battle with this sort of dual feelings for his mother, and the language that she speaks almost represents that alienness. You know, the way she cries, Tamra, Tamra. That is something that even in Tamil, when you read it, you get that sense of, you know, she is outside society. And therefore, you know, when I was translating, I felt that retaining that, you know, the original lines that she says contributes to, you know, retaining that alienness of that character in the translation as well. And you know, I don't know if that answers your question, but
it does. It gets to the specific point, actually. Yeah.
I actually felt that, curiously, that was one of the easier stories to translate.
Oh, that's amazing. It's great to hear. Sorry, Adi, I think you were about to ask something, so go back to you.
Yeah, there's something else that when you take the stories together in terms of translation, like there is a very stylistic, you know, almost blind digression in many narratives. Like these stories seemingly start at one point and they turn into something completely about something else, or there is storytelling within the story. Was that a challenge in translating? Like it should be seamless in the way it is in the original stories as well. Was that a concern?
Yes, I think I think it was a concern in the sense that I wanted to retain what was being done in the original. So for instance, if you look at a story like The Palm Leaf Cross, you know, it's written in three parts, and the second part almost you know, goes off into a biographical account of Howard Somerville, and there is definitely a turn towards a sort of a non-fiction tone in those parts of the story, and I think that was something that I wanted to retain in my translation as well. In fact, in my mentorship program with South Asia Speaks, where I work with Arunava, he actually pointed this out and said, you know, in this place, it almost goes off into a biographical account. Is this something that you want to, I mean, is it intended? And I felt that it was, I mean, while it came out unconsciously when I was translating, when I went back and looked at the original, I felt that was also how Jaimohan had written it. So, yeah, I think, I mean, I hope I've answered your question.
Yeah, you did. And in terms of like the stories, it doesn't really matter that if, you know, people reading it, the translation are not aware of, you know, the real people involved, but you do include a note on the real life characters. Was that suggested, or was that necessary, or is that something that you just want to you know, needs to be acknowledged in a way?
It's there in the original, actually. If you look at the end of the Aram collection in the print form, maybe not in the online form, but Jaimohan has included bios.
I was actually wondering in the sense that in the original story, in Aram itself, is the writer M.V. Venkatra, but that, he's not included, right? I was just wondering if that's something he's spoken about before. I don't know.
There are some people whose identities I think Jaimohan wanted to keep private, and that's the spirit that we've sort of kept to in the translation as well. There was only one exception made, which was Professor J. Sudarshan, but otherwise, you know, he's remained silent on who the writer behind the characters are.
Yeah, I remember watching Bhavacharya's narration of Aram, and he keeps talking about it, and he tries very hard not to mention the name, and then the name comes out, and he's like,
yeah, it's almost an open secret now.
No, I think also the point you raised, right, about the sort of the biographical digression that the stories take. When I read the stories for the first time in Tamil, that's something I noted too. And, you know, I've spoken to Jaimohan about this sort of, it's like narrative nonfiction, but then it's fiction really. So it's almost using the tools of narrative nonfiction to create this fictional overlay. But you know, aesthetically, what it did for me when I read the stories and found these biographical sketches is that it made me feel like this is real. Like these people are not made up. You know, they are not larger than life characters who a writer has thought up. They exist in the world around you. And I think that was the biggest takeaway from Stories of the True from me. That's the sort of idealism is really rooted. It exists here. So I think those sections serve to, at least for me, it helped me believe that it's here and now, that it's grounded. Yeah. So just wanted to add that point.
I was actually going to switch to talking about translating Era Mulagam, but I think it's a very different muscle for Era Mulagam, right? Which is like, it's probably not one of his bigger novels. I mean, considering he's writing Venmurasu, like size is probably out of the window in terms of big novels, but Era Mulagam is like, it's like a, maintains a level of intensity all the way through. That it's very hard. It almost felt like he wrote it in one shot, and I was trying to get a sense of Sushitra how you went about translating that one.
So he did write it in one shot. When he told me he wrote it in 4 or 5 days, I was just gobsmacked.
Sounds about right.
And I asked him, "Didn't you like revise it?" And he said, "No, I just finished writing it. I sent it to my publisher, and they published it, and it came out in the book fair. I had this." Anyway, it was written in one shot, and you're correct, the intensity doesn't flag a bit. It's just, you know, the note stays on point from start to finish. I didn't translate it in 5 days. I took 4 months. So for me, I think I did go back and forth with the manuscript. I think after a point, what happened was, you know, the intensity we feel when we read the novel and we encounter the world for the first time, it's certainly there. But I think when you start getting into the brass tacks, when you start inhabiting the world, something else happens where I think even as a translator, even, you know, when you go sentence by sentence in the book, you kind of become part of that world. You know, you're co-creating that world. You start living that life very intensely. And you know, then it actually becomes quite pleasant. So in the end, that interview that I made with Jay Mohan, he says, in the end, that I asked him, "Did you feel, you know, writing something like this, wouldn't it devastate you emotionally? Like, wouldn't you, how would you feel after writing something like this?" And he said, "No, it's actually very blissful, because you are, you're keeping that world, you're sort of seeing it and you're creating it. So it's almost blissful because it's outside you, and it's coming together in this very organic way. Even that pain, you know, there is pain. It's not that there's not pain, but then it becomes art. It is transformed." So I felt that, like, when I translated the book, it really did feel like that. It didn't affect me in the sort of way that it would have affected me if I'd actually lived that life, I would say. And as far as the translation itself went, you know, the technique, so to speak, it went surprisingly fast, because a lot of the prose was in dialogue. So getting the rhythm of the dialogue was key. And once I had sort of cracked the language that I wanted to use, it was actually quite fast. What was hard was getting those rhythms right and getting the inner language right in English, because in English it sounds very foreign. The prose is written in a dialect. It's written sort of peppered with these swear words and sort of local references and the references to film songs.
And there are two languages, right? And there are Tamil and Malayalam. The Tamil and Malayalam also, yeah.
Yeah. There is Tamil and Malayalam. It's really, you know, half the words sometimes they wouldn't make sense to me, and I would either hazard a guess and then I would check with my friend later, or I would just straight up ask somebody, because it was, actually I think the novel also taught me a little bit of that dialect that he was using. And something also I realized is that this particular dialect doesn't really exist anywhere. It's a language which is, which Jay Mohan has sort of created in a sort of a hyper-realistic way for the sake of the novel. So once you understand the inner engineering that goes in behind the creation of the language, I think it's easy to think of something parallel in English and just go with it. And if it feels right, you just have to make sure that it's consistent and it's right. But yeah, the world itself, now it's very alive to me. It really feels like I've lived that life. And yeah, it's really transformative. I think reading literature and translating literature, that's what it gives you at the end, this sort of transformation by actually having lived something that you will never, ever live in real life.
Yeah, so one question I have, I remember the point about co-creating the world sort of really sticks with me, right? In the past, like in somewhere around the 2013 time, I think Lohitadas had just passed away, and Jaimohan had written a series of articles about Lohitadas on his blog, and reading them, I really felt like it's something that I actually took a quick attempt at translating, because I felt it was very, it was at once personal relationship and sort of a commentary between writing, the ability to write the writing a novel versus writing a screenplay, right? Because there is that dynamic of like, they do talk about the difficulty. At once he talks about his personal relationship with Lohitadas, but also he's talking about the difference between someone who prizes novels versus someone who prizes the stage and screenplay. And one of the things that made me stop translating it was, I felt like there were times in which I felt like I was in the room when he's having a conversation with Lohitadas, and I'm like privy to the conversation myself. And so I have the right to translate it. But then there were other times where I was just mechanically translating words, and I was like, that's not in service of what this article is about at all. And so how do you prevent you do tend to get into the mechanics of like, hey, I want to make sure this word is translated, right? Like, but that's not at all in service of what you want to do. So how do you prevent that? How do you stay conscious of it and sort of prevent that is another question I have.
That's a good question. I think sometimes it does happen that you're just mechanically looking up words and just like working on a single sentence, and it's like the Stroop effect, right? Where you keep saying a word and then it seems like it's just a bunch of sounds in your head, and that sometimes happens. I think the key is to keep a distance. And you know, when that happens, usually when I say keep a distance, of course it's metaphorical. You kind of, but it's also literal sometimes. I have to take a step back from my monitor and just see where that sentence lies in the scheme of paragraphs that's making up this chapter. And sometimes I do it quite literally. Kind of like you see a painting, when you can zoom into a painting and you can see how a particular brush stroke is done. And then you can zoom back and see where it fits with the whole thing. I think it's important to keep going back and forth. And I think it goes both ways. I think with translation, this practice actually helps me to be a better writer, because I think in writing too, you kind of have to sometimes make such choices. You're working with a single sentence. You kind of go back and forth to see how that sounds, and then you're not able to go, proceed further. And the way you go back is to, zoom back and take stock of the whole thing, and then it works. So I think I agree with you. This fly on the wall is a feeling that I often have, when I'm translating something, it's often like I'm peering into how a work was written. So that's, I think, one of the greatest joys that translation gives me, because I'm learning the craft of writing almost. I often make sure that I'm actually like on track there, where I can take a step back and actually understand how each sentence is contributing to the whole, how it's making, how it's creating this whole effect when the parts go together. Just being mindful of it. And I think that's also one reason why I hesitate to take up translations of works where aesthetically it doesn't appeal to me, because I'm not able to learn from it, or there are parts in it which is jarring, and then I'm not really able to make fast progress with it. So I only stick to translating works where I feel like I can learn something from its craft, and where I can relate to how it's written.
Just adding to what Suchitra said there, often what I find is the sentences where that happens is also are also those parts which you haven't really understood as a reader. You know, when that barrier is there, where you've not completely empathized with the text in a particular place, even though you might love the book as a whole. And you know, we keep saying that translator is the closest reader of the text, right? And before you've come to it as a translator, you might have read the book and loved it, but it often happens that there are parts that you don't understand completely, which you gloss over when you're reading it, and you move on and you fill it in with, you know, whatever you've understood of it so far. But as a translator, you don't have the luxury of books that you really have to, you know, grapple with that a lack of understanding and figure out what it is before you can put words on paper. And for me, what I've found useful is to just take a break, just leave it as it is, maybe complete other parts and then come back to it, and you'll find that you get a wholly new perspective on the problem.
That's great, Priyamada. I mean, one thing to add to what you said, just the thought occurred to me, you know, about empathizing. Sometimes there are characters when you read the novel where you kind of, you wouldn't have completely followed their journey sort of emotionally, because you're reading, you're flipping through pages and something gets lost. Yeah, but when you're translating, you live with each character. You go in through the journey of each and every character. And then there's this interplay of character that happens when, if it's a novel or even in a short story, the effect that it leaves you with is something entirely different, something entirely rich. The sort of empathy that you can have with each character, the fact that you are able to make those transitions, I think it, I think that's the greatest thing that we as human beings are able to do through literature. Yeah, so. Does that answer your question, Deepak?
Yeah, it does. So, I mean, that specific part about empathy, that specific part of empathy is kind of what like sticks with me, right? Like, I think the places where I think I ran into that trouble, I think it was primarily, there were two areas. One was I felt a little bit queasy because, you know, that series of articles about Lohi ventures into a little bit of like, it almost gets a little too personal. And so I felt a little queasy translating it. And then the other parts of it where he does take a step back and objectively talk about Lohi, and I think I sort of differ from him in those evaluations. So that's where I was mechanically translating, and so that's when I think I stopped. And so it makes a lot of sense because the empathy point makes a lot of sense, because as a professional translator, you were tasked with translating that article, you can't sort of bring in the fact that you disagreed with him as a reason to stop translating, right? Like, so that makes a ton of sense.
Okay. I was curious about this point that you raised, Sujitra. Like, Jaimon came after a period of modernism, and how it differs from someone like Ashok Mitran's stories. And when I read Ashok Mitran, because, you know, I'm closely associated with cinema more than literature, I tend to look at it at that point of view. And when I read Ashok Mitran's stories, it's always like, this will make for a great movie, but maybe people won't make it because, you know, it's not many people are going to watch it. It's not as, you know, quote unquote entertaining, or it's going to be a quote unquote festival film. But when you read something like Jaimon, it tends to be more attractive in terms of adaptations, and it tends to interest more people. Is that something that can be interpreted from that reading of his place in the modern literature?
I think in a sense, yes. Because, again, building on the point on a shift from modernism, I think there are two things that Jaimon says he sets stock by. One is emotion, and the second is story. And especially, you know, with a work like Arab, he says that he was very clear that he wanted these two elements. And you often find these two elements in, you know, other short stories that he's written, or even novels for that matter. And, you know, that And drama always lends itself well into cinema, right? And I think that's where perhaps more of his short stories are now getting picked up to be made into movies or adapted for the screen in different ways. That would be my two bits. I'm not a... I have to make a disclaimer here that I'm not a movie person and I don't really understand that craft so much, but as someone who reads everyone, this is as much as I can say about it.
Yeah, if I could, I don't know if I have too much more to add, but I agree that maybe short stories are, this is a sentiment that I've heard people more versed in film than I to say that short stories can be better adapted to films because, you know, you can, there's enough room to, for the visuals to work, for music to fill in and things like that, because you're working from a smaller material and you can actually make it grow as opposed to shrinking a novel down, right? So I think, yeah, in that sense, Jaimon's short stories have that emotionality, have that dramatic sense, which might make film adaptations possible. But honestly, you know, when I just think blankly, there are portions of Venmorus, you know, which I mean, I haven't read the whole thing, but I've read enough to kind of understand what he has done with the work. And there are sections of it which are beautiful. They are brilliant. It's a Mahabharata adaptation like none other. And it works. It's primarily literature, but then there are sections of it which I think will look very beautiful on film, will work, will translate very well into film. Like, for example, the section where Draupadi is being disrobed. The novel has this solution that, you know, it's not a mythical god or a superhuman who provides her with clothes to cover herself, but it's the women of the Kaurava clan who throw their clothes to, and you know, the way it plays out in the book, it's really dramatic. It really brings your emotions to the fore because it's telling, it's expressing an old truth in new ways. But I think I can imagine that it would work really well on the big screen too. I imagine some sections of it could be adapted in the future. I'm not sure, but I think I hope that it will be because I think it has good potential.
Yeah, someone in Netflix or Amazon, if you're listening, yeah, open up your coffers. I think I keep going back to that article with Lohi, right? Like I think Jaimon's own perspective on adaptation to screen and thing is changed. In that conversation with Lohi, he talks about how he and Lohi always argued about which was a better or which is a more influential form, or like which is the better form or something like that. And Jaimon obviously always takes the side of the novel, right? Like he's like, it's so expansive and it's so like it gives you so much scope to write. And Lohi's on, and he talks about how Lohi helped him understand like stage and screenplay, where he says you can take all of that emotion, all of that expansive emotion, and you have to lock it into this space, this like constrained space of a stage, or this constrained space of a frame, and that constraint actually produces great work. And I would say like he has probably come to understand like the artistry that goes into writing a screenplay or writing into the mechanics of the stage play. I mean, his film ventures are probably like not anywhere close to the level of his like literary works yet. But I do think Jaimon's own personal position on the art form has probably changed is sort of my sense.
Out of curiosity, have you watched Ori Muri? I think it's the only screenplay where I think only film that he has made where I think his screenplay adds very significantly to the final output that was made. That's my understanding.
So this is the Malayalam movie that he worked on with Jaipal, right? Like I haven't unfortunately.
Yes,
with Madhupal. Sorry, yes, that's right. Unfortunately, I've been in the US and. I mean, Tamil films barely get a wide release here. Malayalam films are almost impossible. So I haven't had a chance to watch it. But if it's streaming somewhere, I will. It's probably one of the canon that I have not seen.
Yeah, if you have a chance to watch it, please do. Because I think, you know, like I said, my disclaimer is I'm not a film person, really. I don't understand what makes a good screenplay in a very technical sense. But, you know, just as a lay watcher of films, I thought the translation of a literary sensibility, sort of a dramatic sensibility on screen, was very well achieved in that film compared to sort of his more popular releases in Tamil. But that's a subjective judgment. But you can watch it.
Yeah, I'll go look it up for sure.
Yeah.
Actually, that reminds me, like to people listening, Suchitran Premadha did an interview of Jayamohan for Scroll, and it's a must read, and I'll link to it in the show notes along with the links to the books. But I want to talk about that because he does mention why he got into screenplay writing, like it's really more of a financial reason or something like that, economic reasons. And but to the interview itself, I find it to be a very important interview, especially in this polarizing time, and even outside of it as a piece of journalistic profiling. I find it a fascinating work that will stand the test of time. So I just want to know how that came about, and it came about after you've been associated with Jayamohan for a few years now, and then it came about now. But how did the conversation itself develop, and how did you what are the things that you really want to talk about? I'm guessing it's not fully like there's another part to it, is what I read. I think I came across something like that. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I think the genesis of that interview really goes back to the mentorship program that I spoke about earlier, the South Asia Speaks mentorship program, in which I worked with Arunava in 2021, and I think last year Suchitra did that. So after we sort of wrapped up the work on Aram, Stories of the Truth, Arunava actually asked me if I'd be interested in interviewing Jayamohan for Scroll. And I said I'd love to. And then, of course, Abyss was also going to be coming out, and Suchitra and I then decided that it'll be interesting to do a translators in conversation with the author kind of a discussion. And that's how it took shape. Of course, we had a few projects in between that sort of delayed the whole thing, but we eventually got to it. Our vision with this interview was really to bring out as much of the personality behind the writer as we could, and not just foreground his works, but his thinking, so to say. So, you know, the first part is in a way introducing his thoughts around this whole debate and discourse around politics versus aesthetics. The second and third parts, I think, will go into the aesthetics of literature much more than the first part did. But we thought, you know, given where a lot of discourse, the point on which a lot of discourse today is shaped, especially in the Anglophone world, is about the politics of literature. And we felt that a counterpoint of view on this is something that should be spotlighted. Suchitra, if you'd like to add to that.
Yeah, and I think we also wanted to do a good job of introducing the English reader to Jayamohan, not just as a writer of novels, you know, not just a storyteller, but also an intellectual and someone who has very decided views and opinions, who's constantly throwing his ideas at his readers, who's trying to converse with people. So I personally think that a lot of Jayamohan's intellectual work, you know, where he talks about culture and religion and history and philosophy, those are ideas that pertain to even people who don't read literature, who don't read fiction. I think it's important. I think those ideas become important only because he has this body of fiction to, and you know, the fact that he has this artistry to back it up. But at the same time, I think people can engage with the ideas too. So we kind of wanted to present the author to the world and not just the fiction. So I think that was also one of our motivations in doing this this long interview. So, like you said, it's in three parts, and the first part is out. We hope to place the other two parts soon, and yeah, I hope that this creates interest in Jaimon. This you know creates a this brings a few more readers to him to sort of broaden our collective perspectives as readers, as people existing in this milieu. I think my understanding of Jaimon's mission too is that he wants to converse with people. He wants to talk to people and engage in a shared mission to deepen our ideas of ourselves. So I think all this could work in that favor.
Yeah, I think that point around Jaimon wanting to converse with people is something that I want to underline. I think in especially the Anglophone discourse that Priyamvada was talking about, right? That and it certainly happens in like actually it's the Tamil discourse is not immune from it either, right? Like you're either the with us or against us framework is sort of very common across languages. And I feel like Jaimon, because of the way he proposes his ideas and sort of the ideas that he proposes himself, he always finds himself to be in the against us camp for a number of people. I do think like I think it's important that what I want to make sure is that what I want to underline the two things that I find from his intellectual ideas is that he makes no bones about the fact that he is like sort of a slightly more conservative thinker, but I do think that that doesn't automatically make him sort of a proto-fascist or whatever, because he does like very unlike a fascist, he is very much about engaging with the ideas and he's very much accepting of the counter of the counterpoint. So I do want to underline that, right? And I think like that comes through in the scroll conversation as well. Suchitra, Priyamvada, I see you're both off mute, so feel free to add.
No, I think I was talking earlier about discovering Jaimon, and for me, it was mostly a literary sort of search that sort of a conversation that I wanted to build with him, which certainly is happening. But I think all of us living in this time and place, you know, in our times, we our questions on more fundamental things, politics or culture or religion, they can get very contentious and controversial, but I think we all have those questions. And I think it's very hard to find people who are knowledgeable and who are willing to have a conversation with you to sort of deepen your own understanding of things. You don't have to necessarily agree with somebody because you talk to them or you have a dialogue with them. What I like about Jaimon is he doesn't set out to convert you, or he doesn't set out to he certainly wants to make an impression, but I don't think it's about a lot of people say this in social media and things like that, you know, he has this bunch of people who say yes to everything he does. No, I don't think that's really true. I think what he's setting out to do is to create conversation, and I think that's very healthy in our times. We really want to understand things for what they are, and you know, not take extreme points or believe what we read on WhatsApp or things like that.
There's just a couple of things that I wanted to add to that. One, I must admit that there's also a little bit of vested interest in doing this interview as translators, because when we went to pitch our books, we were faced with a lot of misconceptions about Jaimon and which camp he falls in and so on and so forth.
Yeah,
and
the scroll interview. Yeah.
Yeah, and we felt that the best way to dispel some of these myths is let the man talk for himself, right? So that was one of the motivations behind doing this interview. Having said that, I also think that it's important to say that as a translator, we are not his mouthpiece, right? So oftentimes we are asked this question of, why would you translate an author like this? And my answer to that is, I really like the work that he's put out there, and I want to translate that work. I may not necessarily agree with all his opinions, and I don't think it's humanly possible for one person to agree with all the opinions of another. But you know, we are not endorsing his views by even if there are certain views that we don't believe in, we are not endorsing it by translating him. And that's an important distinction. I think very often translators are seen as, you know, being in the camp of the author.
No, if anything, we are actually opening him up to more criticism. Which, not just us too, because there's another translator called Aishwarya who did this piece on Savarkar, and it gained a lot of eyeballs. So I think, and I think, you know, it's healthy. It's healthy that that, you know, writers meet more readers, and that's precisely what we want to do. We want to take them into the world in any sort of ability that we can.
And I think one of the things that's that really, I mean, that is a rare quality with him is that there is this self-awareness about him that is not like the instant. It's not like this place and this time. He's self-aware about, like, across his transformation. Like he talks about, like, decades ago I was here, and then 20 years ago I was here, and today I'm here. And that is that is a sort of self-awareness about one's own history that many people don't possess, and they don't have, or they're afraid to face the truth of their past. And I think that is something he completely dispels with, and that really that at least I find it easier to engage with something like that. And I think many people have that problem of not having that self-awareness, and therefore they themselves have a fear of encountering it.
So growth is a part of life, and I think we all grow in our opinions. We change opinions. We do wrestle with ourselves, right? And for writers, for people who record sort of their growth like you do in a lab notebook, like you use a science metaphor, you basically make a little note every day as to what your ideas are, where you're coming from, and all that. And I think it's important, this is something which Jaimon told me once, and he said that a writer is somebody who stretches out in front of the world like a corpse on an autopsy table. So you do keep yourself before the world, and that's the sort of honesty that you're bringing to the world. Like, I know that, you know, I think it's rather unfortunate in one sense that we've talked about all the democratization of literature, that it's available on the internet and all that, but what often happens is that writers who have this sort of a very clinical process, they end up being compared with people who have not put in that sort of work, but who possess a social media account and have opinions. And then, you know, just like with the social media account, you can go back and pull some tweet from 2015 and say, hey, you said this thing which is really regressive. How dare you say that? And I think for all of us, we have this graph, and our ideas evolve, they change. I think it's good that, like you said, that's the self-awareness is very important to, if you think you're somebody whose ideas matter and you're in public life, I think it's important that you have that self-awareness.
Before we wrap, Adi, Sujitra Premada, what is coming down the pike in terms of work for both of you, in terms of translations or even other things that you're working on? Because I see you have Muri, or it's something that you guys have started. Love to learn more about what you guys are working on as well before we wrap, so that our audience can be aware as well.
I'm working on my second translation. So this is again Jaimon's novel Vellayani, and the one for which I was fortunate to get a Penheim fellowship, translation grant last year. I've pretty much completed a full draft of the novel, and I'm working on now pitching it to publishers and then finishing up the manuscript. I have two or three ideas for what I want to do next, but I think I'll probably take a break before I put serious thought into it.
So I'm almost wrapping up the translation of a second Jaimohan novel. It's called Kumari Thurungi. The novel was published in 2018, 2021, so it's pretty recent. It's a short novel. And I've started work on the big one. It's called Vishnupuram. It's one of Jaimohan's most, it's a novel that he's most well known for, and just started work on it. Yeah. And apart from that, Murri is this initiative that Priyamada and I set up. I mean, we, she said earlier, we met in one of these readers camps that was organized by Jaimohan, and we stayed in touch since then. And then when we started to translate Jaimohan, we started to talk more about translations, craft, things like that. And then, you know, one thing we realized is within India, there's not a lot of space where you can talk about translations, where you can talk about literatures in Indian languages. In English, most of what's written about literature is what's written, what's published in English itself, not translations into English. And I think that landscape is slowly changing. Like over the past few years, there's a market for translations that picked up and translations are being reviewed. But there's still far and few between. And I think Indian literature is not just literature written in English. There's a whole body of intellectual activity that's happening in each and every Indian language. And I'm sure, you know, the two of us can't cover everything for sure. But I think what we wanted to do was to do a sort of a community thing where we crowdsource articles, where we talk to people, where, you know, I think the way we envision it is a process of learning for ourselves. So what we aim to do on the website is to publish translations, critical pieces, features on writers working in various languages. And you know, if possible, we want to do something similar to what you're doing with the podcast, where we meet up with a writer and a translator or a critic from a language to learn more about you know, their work in depth and to showcase it. And we hope that by doing this, we can create a community of people working in various Indian languages, and you know, their translators, and bring this to the front and center of Indian literature. We also realize that when we think about what's presented as Indian literature abroad, I mean, I know it's not presented by somebody, but it's just the way it's happened historically. In anywhere in the West, Indian literature brings to mind writers who write in English, like Salman Rushdie or Arundhati Roy, or even Naipaul for that matter. But we have equally good writers who write in Indian languages. So we kind of want to change that conversation a bit. And so that's just the reason behind the movie. We also want to identify translators. So we conducted a translation contest last year, and we identified about 9 really promising translators who've also gone out to start doing great work. But we hope to do more in the coming years. That's about movie.
That's awesome. Thank you so much for giving us the lowdown, and good luck on the next endeavors.
Yeah, so that's about Jaimohan and Sucharan Premata's translations, and Stories of the True. I link to the book in the show notes, and also link to the scroll interview and a few other related works. Thank you, Sucharan. Thank you, Premata, for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Deepak and Aditya, for having us.
Thank you so much. It was lovely being here.
Excellent.
Hey folks, this is Deepak, aka Complicatua on Twitter, and I wanted to personally thank you for listening to our latest episode. If you liked what you heard, please subscribe to The Other Banana on Apple, Google, Spotify, Amazon, or any of the other platforms where you listen to podcasts. Please do leave us a review and a rating, as it helps us drive visibility for our work. You can also view the team's writing or provide us feedback on our content at tobpod.com. We look forward to hearing from our listeners soon. Thank you.